Going to read from 1 Peter now. For Peter there says of the Christians, whether they be of Jewish background or others that have joined in with the dispersed Jewish Christians. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9. But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people belonging to God, that you may declare praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. That equation of the people at Sinai with the New Testament Christians believing in Christ, the believers, is very, very interesting. From a certain point of view, what we're going to cover today will have a tremendous impact on what your eschatological position basically is. I don't know if how much of this you would agree with, how much you are aware of this, but in a sense, your eschatology will be greatly determined by what you understand God was doing with Israel as recorded in Exodus 19. When he covenanted with them, when the theocracy was formally established, and when he stated what the purpose or the relationship was to be, the law that follows that, the confirmation. You know, we speak of eschatology embedded in creation. Mr. Dumbrell has a book on that. He picks up six themes from Revelation. He finds them right back there in Genesis and traces them right through the entire scriptures. And the book that I'm working on now, I call it Creation, History, and Consummation. And I have found that Dumbrell has indeed got a very basic point. And Tony Hukuma, Dr. Anthony Hukuma, in his book, The Bible and the Future, also points out your understanding of creation is indeed going to determine your eschatology and how your eschatology is worked out, because the end is embedded in the beginning. What God intended, he carries out. And he doesn't throw any curves, and he doesn't miss any points. Now, I guess my eschatological slip is showing when I say that as to what happened when Jesus was on earth. Well, we have this passage, 1 Peter 2. I hope we can get back to it right toward the end of the semester. But now we'll turn to Exodus 19 and see if we can get the basic theological perspectives from Exodus 19 to Numbers 10. Let us pray. Lord our God, you've given us a tremendous revelation. You've done great things. You've said great things, and then you've done them also. You've carried them out, and we are the blessed beneficiaries, the recipients of many blessings today. God, your grace is wonderful. Your love is immeasurable, steadfast. You never fail us. We experience that in everyday experiences also, even as one in the class again has had that experience this past week with a grandmother dying and a mother becoming ill. God, you uphold us, and we thank you for that. Continue to sustain us. Give us what we need during this hour. For Jesus' sake, amen. All right, the outline is on the board. And we begin in Exodus 19, and it wouldn't take much of an effort at all to just stay with Exodus 19 for the whole period. But we also have to move on. The first two verses of Exodus 19 tells us that it was in the third month after the Israelites left Egypt. On that very day, they came to the desert of Sinai. After they had set out from Rephidim, they entered the desert of Sinai, and Israel camped there in the desert in front of the mountain. And Moses went up to God. The Lord called him from the mountain and said, "This is what you are to say to the house of Jacob, and what you are to tell the people of Israel." That's verse 3. There, Moses is commanded to be God's mouthpiece. Moses has to function as a prophet. Go and say to the people. And there we have direct communication. God speaking to Moses. Just how that interaction takes place is beyond us. But here again we have an aspect of that supernaturalism that we come across again and again in the Old Testament as well as in the New. God spoke to Moses. And tell the house of Jacob, the people of Israel. Notice Jacob and Israel. Jacob, the personal name. Israel, the official name that God gave him when he struggled with Jacob at Peniel. Go tell these people, these descendants of the man who struggled with God, God hasn't let them go. Tell them. And then in a couple of phrases, and I often kind of get a little bit of a tingle in the spine when I think of how Moses, quoting God, could just sum up in two little phrases all that had happened. You have to be a bit of a bird watcher, I guess, to understand this one. I have a son-in-law who can tell an eagle, a hawk, any type of a bird from a distance. Have you ever watched eagles? Now and then I watch the on Channel 9, I watch these here nature programs, you know, and every now and again there's a little program about the eagles. Amazing birds. But I have seen eagles out California where I grew up, and I've seen eagles up in the foothills, up on the trees. And this past summer we were up in northern Michigan and we saw the nests of the bald eagles. Nests weighing a couple of tons. These birds carry logs, at least that's what it looked like, up into the top of a tree. And they build a house, an inverted house, because it's a nest. And then when the young are ready to fly, Mother Eagle has a way of nudging them out over the edge, and there they are, the eagle. And Mother jumps and swoops underneath and picks them up and carries them back to the nest. Eagles are known to do that too. When they have their nest way up on the cliffs, they nudge the little fledglings out and just kind of let them plummet and let them fly, and they'll scoop underneath and pick them up and carry them back to the nest. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt. There he talks in just those few words about all the plagues and all the destruction, the death of those firstborn and all that, and how I carried you on eagle's wings. I carried you. It doesn't say like a mother carries her baby, but like an eagle carries its young. Evidently in the desert area they were able to see the eagles there too. And God said, yeah, I nudged you out of the nest. I nudged you out of Egypt. You saw what I did to Egypt. I got you out of there. And I've been teaching you to walk, and I've been teaching you to fly. And I had to come and scoop you up a few times, you know, when the sea was in front of you and when the water got pretty salty, you thought you couldn't drink it, and you were tired already of meat, and I gave you all those birds. Look, I picked you up and carried you like a mother eagle. You know, in Ezekiel 16, you get another picture of how God speaks of how he took care of Israel. Then it was that he found Israel as a little newborn babe that hadn't been washed, that hadn't been cleansed, that hadn't been mollified with oil, and God found that little babe. Well, there are these different pictures that we have in the Bible of how God took care of these people, an unorganized mass of slaves turned free, and God carried them. But he didn't just carry them. The next thing that is said there, and I brought you to myself. The last word I have on the outline is Emmanuel. This whole passage is the story of Emmanuel, God with his people. God didn't ever forsake them. He brought them to himself. What do you read into a little phrase like this, and I brought you to myself? That's explained when we go to the statements of assurances. But what does a bridegroom do when he goes through the marriage ceremony and he takes his bride to the home that's just set up? What have you done, you married guys? What was done to you, ladies? The man left, he took you, and cleaves to you. Right? That's what God did. God took his bride out of Egypt. He nurtured her, he wooed her according to Ezekiel 16, and I brought you into my embrace. And I brought you to myself so that we could be brought together in a beautiful bond. Well, the covenant bond was there. But the people that had been in Egypt for all those years, they had not had much instruction. They may not have been aware. But at the same time, we did see last time, God remembered, God knew they were his people. Now, moving on. What are the assurances that these people receive as God brings Israel to himself, into his embrace? The whole earth is mine. There you have that cosmic kingdom, which some may want to refer to as the creation covenant, put right before their face again. I am the king. I am the Lord of it all. The whole earth, every nation, every aspect. This big Mount Sinai is mine too. Everything. The whole earth is mine. Now, in this whole earth, and from all the nations in this earth, what does he say? If you obey me fully and keep my commandments. There we have that im again. It is this strict conditionality. Oh, there's a lot of argument again. You know, they speak about the Abrahamic covenant being the covenant of promise, and this is being the covenant of works and law. Well, there's no doubt about it. We have that little word im. I have it there in Hebrew on the board. Is that to be interpreted strictly in a legalistic causality way? Now, it's going to be all up to you. In a sense, yes. But remember what has been stated before. Here's the case. I broke Egypt. I carried you as a mother eagle carries her eaglets. I brought you to myself. Here you are. Now, what are you going to do? God doesn't treat his people like a block of wood or a bunch of sticks or anything like that. And he addresses them as responsible people and says, if we're going to be married and we're going to have a happy marriage, there is a certain condition, in quotes, there's certain requisites, certain things that are definitely going to have to take place. I'm going to expect something from you, not for the creation of the covenant, not for the creation of the theocracy, not for the creation of your future. That's established. You're going to stay in this relationship? You're going to stay married to me? You're going to be a faithful bride? And then he speaks of Israel as his bride in these four terms here. First of all, in three terms, you will be my segula. That's the Hebrew word, segula. And it's best translated, my treasured possession. You're going to be my darling, colloquially speaking. You'll always be my darling, the apple of my eye. I'll love you with my whole heart. You will have that love. But the only way you have that love is if you stay in my arms, if you stay within my embrace. The only way you'll have that love is you staying in covenant with me, maintaining the relationship that I have established, maintaining the bond that is now being formalized between you and me. Yes, God puts an onus on his people. God demands a response. God has set the situation. This being the situation now, this being the hypothesis, you're my segula, you are mine, I brought you to myself. You'll always be my treasured possession, obeying, following, living as a bride. Refuse to live as a bride, you won't be a bride. God doesn't give Israel an option, choose you not what you want to be. He says, I brought you to myself. This is the situation. Now be a bride. Be a bride, you will be my blessed treasure all the way. Please understand, the situation is, in a way, an accomplished fact. Israel is with God. God has done it all there at Sinai. Then he goes on to give them this assurance that they are to be a kingdom of priests. Now, Peter picks this up too. The priestly kingdom or a kingdom of priests. You can find commentators arguing quite a bit as to which way is best to say it. Are they to be seen as a priestly kingdom with the emphasis on priestly, or is the emphasis on kingdom of priests? Well, I think that it doesn't make that much difference which way you want to look at it, by any means. But one thing is sure, the idea of kingdom tells them that they are to see themselves as under the rule of God. They are God's domain. And if you want to stress the great sovereignty of God, you'll say a kingdom of priests. But if you want to emphasize what God wants them to be on earth, then you say a priestly kingdom. What was God saying when he said, "You will be to me a kingdom of priests"? Not only that I'm your ruler, but you must function as a priestly people. You must stand between me and the whole earth that's mine. You are to represent the earth. Now, what had God said at the time of creation when he told Adam and Eve, have dominion, cultivate? Well, there too, Adam had to not only represent God to the whole of creation in a royal way, he had to represent creation to God. He had to bring a beautified, cultivated, dominated, and named creation before the presence of God to the glory of God. Now, God is saying to Israel, I'm only giving you the Adamic command that I gave in creation. I want you to be a kingdom of priests. I want you to bring all the nations and the earth before them, before me as my kingdom. So Israel becomes the central kingdom, God's agency, through which he will bring his blessing to the nations. Hey, remember Genesis 12? This ties right in with Genesis 12. And I will bless you and you will be a blessing to all the nations. But the priestly aspect points out now that all the nations are to come into the presence of God through Israel. Israel is to pray for the nations. Israel is to work for the world. That's your function. I didn't bring you, Abram, out of the Ur of the Chaldees and brought you here between the three great nations, the nations of the Mesopotamian Valley, the nations of North, West, South, East Europe, the Hittite land, and that North East corner of Africa, Egypt, those three big areas, and put you in the middle. I didn't do that for the fun of it. I claim those people. They're mine. Mine by creation, and mine by the reconfirmation of the creation covenant with Noah. Noah's sons, through Noah's sons. They're mine. And I want you to bring them to me. There's a repetition in that phrase of the great Old Testament missionary mandate. And it surely tells us what we have to do. If, as Peter tells us, and we are that kingdom of priests today, the church today, go to the nations, bring in the nations. Well, we know the prophets talk about that. Jesus talked about that. But don't forget that phrase, the whole earth is mine, and the earth is not limited not just to nations. The whole ecological, the environmental situation, hey, we as God's kingdom of priests, we should be right in the forefront of that. I'm not saying that that means you go along with anything that some of these radical environmentalists say, but we better become a little bit more ecologically concerned also. You know, we're often accused that we take this cultural mandate seriously, and therefore we think God says go and exploit this world. No. We are to beautify this world too. And that is again to the priests were the representatives of beauty. The priests were the representatives of cleanliness. The priests were the representatives of wholeness and integrity. Everything that really functioned to bring peace in creation as a whole, but also amongst people in creation. The task of the priest, see to it that the threefold cultural mandate is properly carried out. The relationship to the cosmos, relationship to one another, and the relationship to God. Oh, the priest stood right in the middle of that. And you today, class, you're priests by God's appointment. Peter reminds us of that. And then, the fourth thing, the whole earth is mine. You're my blessed treasure. You're my kingdom of priests. And you're my holy nation. And that's a twofold phrase there again, too. A goy kadosh. Goy. And he uses the term that indicates not the covenantal relationship that the word Ami, my people, indicates, but Goy. I'm going to look upon you as a political unit. You'll be a governed people. You're going to be a state, but you're also going to be a governed people. Now, many people don't know the difference, or don't seem to indicate an awareness of the difference between state and government. We, here in the United States, we have a state made up of 50 states. We're talking about the domain. We're talking about our area. We're talking about the functions, etc., and so on. But government is how a state is administered, how it's run, how it's governed. Now, what did God say to these people? He said to them, you are to see yourself as a political unit. And the emphasis is not so much now again on territory, but it's on people. goy. You are to see yourself as an organized people. You are to see yourself as a political unit, a governed unit. God's not, first of all, saying, and the all-important thing is now that you become a state. Look, that's what the nations, other nations did, and Israel always wanted to put a lot of emphasis on the state, their property, their land, and I think some Christians still get carried away with that to an extent. But God's emphasis is, I want you to be a people that are organized, that can serve as a kingdom of priests. But Goy puts emphasis on the political, organized, governed dimension. You've got to be a governed people, an organized people, a united people, under control. But as you are that, you must also be holy, completely sanctified unto me. Now, I said to you, it was easy to spend the whole hour on this passage. We've got to move on. But I hope that you have it clearly in mind now what God said to these people. He had laid the historical foundation. He had laid the theological foundation. Everything was there. Now, Israel, what is your response? And in this passage, Exodus 19-24, three times the people are asked to respond, and each time they say, all that the Lord has said, we will do. When I got married to my dear little wife, they only asked her to say, I do one. That was enough. I don't know of many marriage ceremonies that call for more than one I do from the woman, or from the man for that matter. Maybe they ought to have three of them these days to solidify this anti-divorce movement, huh? But look, and the people said, all that the Lord has said, we will do. There was the response. And in a way, the marriage knot was tied. The covenant was formulated at the very heart there. The response, all that the Lord has said, we will do. And you know, there's two little phrases that have to be seen there in that passage. Call all the people and unitedly. And they did it as one voice. God had brought them together. He had placed them there before him. And there was not a dissenting voice. From then on, the onus could truly be on the people. God having done his part, and all that the people had to do was say, God, you're great. God, you're wonderful. Here we are. The covenant was consolidated, and we jump ahead a minute to chapter 24, verses 5-7. After the law was given, we'll talk about that in a minute, then Moses had to bring the people before Israel, before God again. And then he built an altar, and that's where we have the ceremony. The animal is killed, half the blood is taken in a bowl, poured on the altar. The other half of the blood is taken, and the people aren't dipped in it, and the people are not immersed in it, but the people are sprinkled. And the blood is sprinkled on the people, and they are sealed by the blood of the covenant. Sealed by the blood of the covenant. The covenant has been confirmed now also by ceremony, by blood, by the death of a substitute animal. How that points forward to when Christ later says, I am the mediator of the covenant. I shed my blood for the remission of sin. These people could stand there and know that they were a forgiven people. They were a cleansed people. God had made them a holy people. They had been sealed by the blood of the covenant. But that didn't happen until the people for the third time said, all that the Lord has said we will do. The covenant was consolidated by oath, by ceremony. I put the oath and ceremony there in one package. But in chapters 20-23, we have the law. Now, Voss gives us an extended discussion on the law, and he goes into detail in the first four. He must have run out of time in his lectures, so he couldn't get into the next six. But what was the purpose of that law? Let me put it simply. Housekeeping rules for a good marriage. You understand that? Maybe you are not married. No, don't. But when you got married, if you didn't actually spell it out, didn't you and your husband come up with some type of living arrangement? Of course. God didn't now say to his people, be a holy people, be and now go do as you please. First thing he says, I only. No other gods before you. I'm your only husband. Jeremiah talks about God being the husband, and I was a husband to you. No other husbands, no other lovers. And I don't want you to go around carrying pictures or any type of semblance of another lover. Second commandment. Me, none other. Me only. You are mine, and I am yours. No images. Anything like that. Anything that would somehow or another distract from that spiritual covenantal relationship, that third mandate, the fellowshipping mandate. Nothing between, except my priest. Is that clear? I give you my name. From now on, you're going to be called Ami, my people. And if you mistreat my name, you'd mistreat me. Because you can't separate me. I've given you my name, the I am that I am. Don't you go to work and start making fun of my name, be it Anderson or be it Ong or whatever. Now that I've given you my name, honor it. And use it as a means of drawing the nations, and not in trying to show your own boldness or brashness or whatever. And I want you to take time to love me. Because when you really love me, I know that we will stay together. But love takes time. Love takes time. So I give you 6 days a week to be doing your work out there in creation, all that interaction. But I want 1/7 of your time for me. Remember that day of rest, that goal that I've set before you, that I've achieved myself in creation, that I've set before you. Remember that. We need time now and for the future. If there's ever one commandment today that people, by saying that they live in the New Testament age, flaunt, it is this. A football game seems to be taking precedence over time to be with family, God's family, and the Lord. The things that are done on the day of worship today, they're so sadly overshadowed that the first three commandments pretty well go by the way. You can pretty well determine how much the first three commandments, first three rules for God's housekeeping with His bride, are honored by the way time is taken. But then God goes on and talks about the social aspects. You shall not have your children, the fifth commandment, dishonor their father and mother, keep the family intact. The sixth commandment, don't be attacking each other, killing, and preserve that marriage bond. Three commandments that relate to the covenantal social mandate. And don't you steal. And don't you covet. The ninth, the eighth, and the tenth commandment are very important too. They deal particularly with the way we look on the cultural dimension of life, the material aspect. The ninth one, take care of your neighbor's name in the midst of the whole cultural situation. And there that's a combination of the fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth and ninth, in how you deal with your fellow people in the cultural and in the social situation. And as long as you remember their honor, their claims in society, their relationships, all will be well. 10 good guidelines for a good marriage. That's what the law basically is. It was for themselves personally. It was for their relationship with God. It was for their relationship with each other, with the world. Beautiful guideline. God shows us how to love Him. Guidelines for love. That's what the law is. And these people that make the law a legalistic situation, they forget the heart of the law, which Jesus Himself said. And what is the heart of the law? You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. You shall love your neighbor yourself. Love is the heart of the law. And I know if you love me, you will show it by keeping my commandments. It comes right out of Exodus 20, 19 to 24. Israel was given this in detail. And these laws really covered the whole of life. Got to move on now to this whole concept of theocracy. When God married His people in that formal way there at Sinai, He established what we call the theocracy. But can you find that word in the Bible? Well, I guess we can't use it then. It's not there. Some would argue, you know, you can't talk about covenant of creation because the word berith isn't in Genesis there, and then we can't talk about theocracy either. And yet it's one of the handy terms that we have to refer to what? Theo, God, Kratos, power. God's power, God's sovereignty, God's rule on earth. The theocracy is God and now formalizing how he's going to exercise his reign over his domain, his people, and through his people. Theocracy puts emphasis on the reign, the power of God. How is God going to reign over his people? He has just pointed this out. You'll be my segula, you'll be my treasured possession, you'll be my kingdom, a priest, and you will be my holy, well-organized, regulated, governed people. And that's the way I'm going to reign over you and through you. And I'm going to reign myself. I'm going to have my representatives. Moses is first of all to represent me. And he'll do that in threefold office. He represents, I've already said to him, speak. He's the one that's got to tell you the law, administer the law, the royal dimension. He's the one that brought the sacrifice when the blood was sprinkled on the people. So Moses right there functions in the threefold capacity as prophet, priest, and king. Now I reign through my threefold office, which is now represented in Moses, and Moses therefore is my great mediator. But I want you to trust Moses. And you know, that is stated right here in the passage too that is before us in Genesis 19. I want you to trust him because he speaks for me. He rules for me. He sacrifices on my behalf. He prays on your behalf. The theocracy is God's reign over his people. And he doesn't say to Moses, Moses be king. I am the king. Now, three points that I want to stress here for a moment. By the way, Voss mentions the theocracy must not be seen as a missionizing agency. Oh, that's very true. But three things we indeed have to see here about the theocracy. I think I put these on the board here. Yes, the theocracy, or I even have the four there. Kingdom on earth, symbol, type, and the tabernacle there. It is, as I point out there, God's kingdom on earth. He has said, you are my kingdom, my organized people. Now, but they are to serve as a symbol. Now, what is a symbol? A symbol is a representation of a fuller, greater reality. So, the theocracy, this as God put his reign over his people, symbolized God, the Creator King, over the whole of creation, but he centers this now in Israel. And Israel symbolizes to the world how God is the great King. But if a symbol is truly a symbol, and Voss discusses this in the context of the tabernacle too, if a symbol is truly a symbol, it is also a type. And a type is never a type, unless it's first of all a symbol. I want to refer here now to the tabernacle a moment. That tent, by the way, consider this east. The opening had a face this way. The tabernacle is a symbol of what? Emmanuel, God with us. It indicates that God, the spiritual, infinite, everywhere present one, but invisible, has made his home with us. He is truly with you. I will be with you. I will dwell in your midst. Look at the tabernacle. That's the symbol of my presence. But now it also functions as a type. What does it really refer to? Who is the real Emmanuel? John 1. And who is it that came and tabernacled amongst us? Who is the true Emmanuel? And when he was born, you shall call his name Emmanuel. Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ. Now, when the type is fully realized, when Christ has come, the symbol need no longer function because the reality has come. And that's what the book of Hebrews tries to emphasize so emphatically and so specifically and persistently. Forget about the theocracy. Forget about the temple. Forget about the priesthood. Forget about the sacrifices. That was the sacrifices, the priesthood. That was, they all pointed to Christ. When the reality is here, you don't go back to the types and the shadows and the symbols. They're finished. Don't resurrect that again. They have performed their duty. You can read about them to better understand the antitype. And so the tabernacle is the first thing that God tells Moses to establish, because that is to really represent the heart of the theocracy. I'm reigning over you. I'm here with you. Look to the tabernacle. And don't just see it as a place of worship, but see it as a place from which I reign, from which I direct, from which I control, from which I speak, from which I show you my love, from which I minister to you, so that you can indeed be priestly. Now, I know that I may be a bit tough on some of you people that somehow or another want to see the theocracy reestablished on earth. And I'll tell you right now why I find it terribly difficult to accept the premillennial eschatological position. Because that calls for a reestablishment of the symbol. But the symbol has done its duty. There's no purpose for it anymore. The reality has come, Jesus Christ. The kingdom, as Jesus himself said, is with you, he is among you. The reign of God through Christ has come. And the people had to know that God was reigning, but before Jesus Christ became flesh on earth, how could the people know that God was truly reigning, that God was Emmanuel, that the theocracy was a reality? The tabernacle. That was the palace. Remember, the palace garden had to be vacated, Eden. But God keeps the palace one way or another. For a while, with the patriarchs, hardly possible. But there was the altar that Abram built. Now, keep that tabernacle. And when we get to Joshua, we'll see that at the heart of the tabernacle was the ark. The ark of God's presence. Did Israel remain faithful to God? Did Israel understand what they had said, all that the Lord has said we will do? When Moses is up in the mountain getting the instructions concerning the tabernacle, and also the priests that were to function the tabernacle, under Aaron's guidance and direction, the golden calf, law number one, law number two, are tragically disobeyed. And God says, I'm going to wipe those people. Moses, go down. And when Moses sees what's happening, he breaks the Ten Commandments and he says, the covenant is shattered. They're not keeping God's will. And God said, and now I will make of you, he said to Moses, the great nation. And Moses becomes the mediator par excellence. And he prays. And he prays. And he prays for his fallen people. He prays for God's wandering bride. Oh, Lord, your name. Lord, your name. And what happens? The curse is applied. Quite a number of people died right then and there. Notice that first of all. The curse is applied, the curse of the covenant. Certain people. And why the ones that were killed were killed? I won't go into detail on that. I couldn't, because I really don't know. But there were a number there that were wiped right then and there. But as I also put on the board there, not only did Moses function as a mediator, but notice how God makes himself known in Exodus 34, verse 6 and 7. And this passage you will find repeated in the Psalms. And Jonah, when he was angry because that vine had died, said, God, I knew that you were a God slow to anger, full of compassion. I knew that you'd be to the Assyrians just like you said you'd be to Israel. Exodus 34, verse 6. The Lord, Yahweh, the I am that I am, the I am that I am, the compassionate one, who suffers with, compassion means to suffer with, the gracious God, who has love for the guilty, who is slow to anger, and the term there is of a long nose, of a long breath. God knows how to take a deep breath. He abounds in love, in faithfulness. He maintains his chesed. He forgives the wicked. He forgives rebellion. He forgives sin. But he'll never leave the guilty unpunished. And the justice and righteousness of God comes through. But you know, there are more terms used to describe the wonderful character of God as compassionate and loving, gracious and patient, than are referred to as righteousness and justice in the face of rebellion and sin. God is a forgiving God, and Israel, the bride, was forgiven, even though they had committed a tragic act of adultery, spiritual adultery, in bowing before that golden calf and calling it the God of Egypt. What an adultery! God forgave. But some had the curse applied that they might know the consequences. But for the people as a whole, the theocracy remained, God's reign on earth. And the reign of God is a reign of compassion. It's a reign of grace. It's a reign of patience. It's a reign of love. It's a reign of faithfulness. It's a reign of upholding love through all generations. It's a reign of forgiveness. But it's a reign of justice and righteousness too. What a God. What a gracious God. Had he really expressed the curse of the covenant to a full degree, there would never have been Jesus Christ, Emmanuel. But he maintained his people so that down the road, through his people, the Christ would come, who would bring all these virtues to even fuller and greater expression.